Welcome to What is Restorative Justice Really? Episode 39 of Co-Creating Peace, a series about conscious communication and conflict transformation. I'm Kathleen Alwigon. I am so pleased to have my friend and colleague, Tanya Covington, join me today to talk about a very important field of mediation, especially in today's world. It is a powerful yet underutilized form of mediation known as restorative justice. It used to be known as victim-offender mediation. But first, the quote for today. Today's quote is by Fania Davis. Our justice system harms people who harm people to show that harming people is bad. Restorative justice interrupts that process. Tanya Covington was appointed by the mayor of Albuquerque to bring restorative justice to the city. She is the immediate past president of the New Mexico Mediation Association. Tanya has been a trained mediator and teacher of mediation since 1988. Tanya has expertise in restorative justice, workplace, family, transformative, cross-cultural, postal redress, divorce, and elder mediation.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Tanya, to talk about restorative justice mediation.
Well, thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So, Tanya, I have briefly mentioned restorative justice mediation in a previous podcast when I was giving some examples of the power of mediation, but I didn't really give a full description of what restorative justice mediation is. Can you help our listeners understand more about restorative justice mediation and the contexts in which it is used?
Sure. First of all, restorative justice is a little different than standard mediation. It uses some techniques that aren't used in standard mediation. Restorative justice is a community-based approach to justice that focuses on rehabilitating responsible parties and repairing the harm that's done to victims. Restorative justice really helps victims and communities heal while holding responsible parties accountable for their actions. So I always like to say it's conflict resolution with an emphasis on healing.
Nice. When you refer to responsible parties, I'm assuming that's someone who has committed some kind of a crime. Is that right?
Or any kind of infraction. It doesn't have to be a crime. We use it a lot in communities. It's not always a crime. It's, you know, if two neighbors are having a big squabble and it's affected the rest of the neighborhood, we bring everybody in and talk about it. So it's not always a crime.
Interesting. And it also sounds like it doesn't always involve only the people directly involved in the situation, but restorative justice mediation brings in other people who were perhaps indirectly affected. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's one of the big differences in restorative justice practices as opposed to standard mediation is restorative justice really is community-based. And whatever goes on with people, it tends to affect the people around them. We all live in community and all have families. And so it's pretty rare that something will happen to somebody and it only affects them. And in order to set things right, we need to bring together everybody who is involved or everybody who's affected.
Wow, that's such a unique approach. And so you just spoke a little bit about how restorative justice differs from other kinds of mediation. How does restorative justice differ from the punitive justice that we use in the normal legal justice system?
Well, restorative justice really seeks to repair what's wrong and whatever has been broken. And it does allow those closest to the issue to design the solution, but it's definitely almost always done in a more communal setting.
And so you said that the parties involved design the solution. So there is nobody in the restorative justice process that imposes what will happen next. Is that right?
Right. And that's another way that it's different from punitive justice or from going to court. There is no judge. There are no attorneys. Everything gets decided by the people who are actually involved. It's one of the reasons that people like restorative justice is because they get the opportunity to speak for themselves rather than somebody outside of them making decisions for them.
All these different things that you're talking about are so different from what we see normally. And, you know, another thing that we see normally so often is that when somebody commits a crime or causes an infraction, as you say, that there's some kind of retribution or revenge or punishment. How does that play into restorative justice?
Well, it doesn't really play in. We sort of suffer from a misguided notion that removing somebody from society or locking them up and throwing away the key is enough. But really, no other person's pain lessens your suffering or replaces your loss. So it doesn't make sense to always do that. And one of the things that we find so often when people go to court, the victim at the end of it says, you know, I didn't get what I thought I was going to get. I don't feel better. I never got a chance to talk to the person who did whatever. I never got a chance to ask them why me. And that's something that almost all victims want to know. And in restorative justice, that's how we start. There is, you know, getting people to be able to talk to each other and to listen to each other. And responsible parties have to apologize and take responsibility for what they've done.
So there isn't any kind of punishment. And so if there's no punishment and it's really about that healing process that you're talking about, which sounds very, very powerful, and for the victim to have the opportunity to find out why they were the target of whatever happened and get that sort of closure, perhaps. And yet at the same time, with all of that, which sounds really beautiful, doesn't restorative justice let people off the hook kind of easily? And wouldn't that incite them to perhaps think they could get away with it again?
Not really. And people are surprised by that. But if you're convicted of a crime and put to jail, usually you don't have to apologize. You don't have to make amends. You don't have to face the victim or answer any questions that the victim has. But in restorative justice, you have to do all of that. And you have to listen to the victim tell you how what you did affected them, their family, and their community. I've had many people tell me that that's harder than going to jail. And that's one of the things that keeps them from repeating it. If you know, you have to look somebody in the face and hear them tell you how what you did affected them. That's not easy. It really is difficult, and it makes people think twice before they do it again, which is one of the reasons why we have such a very low recidivism rate with restorative justice.
And it sounds like that face-to-face conversation, which I can imagine would be pretty scary and difficult, perhaps for all parties involved. And yet at the same time, I'm imagining as I'm listening to you that there is a more human connection that is created. It's no longer responsible party and victim. It's two human beings relating to one another and to each other's thinking. And as you point out, the impacts of experiences with one another.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we find so much when we do this in the community is people who have had infractions done to them, it's usually by somebody else who's in their own community. And they have to look at that person. They have to see them. And there's some sort of a relationship there. And so, yeah, it is very difficult to do that, especially if you know that it's somebody that you're going to be seeing on a regular basis. But it also is so very good for building community. Once people get over something like this, the community is so, so much stronger.
Interesting. And I can imagine that that would certainly be the case. And also, I would imagine that because you're bringing in the larger community, not just the two or three people involved, that there's a sense of connection and perhaps even personification rather than objectification of one another. Yeah?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Because what happens when people come together, then it's the whole community solving a problem. The whole community having input, the whole community making sort of a pledge that they're not going to allow this to happen again. So it really does give people a new way of relating to each other. Most people definitely find the process a lot more satisfying because they really are building their community. And once people look at each other as community members, that really lessens an awful lot of the problems that we have.
I can imagine. And it sounds like it's a unifying kind of process.
Very much so.
So then that sounds like there's a lot involved in bringing people together and going through, I'm guessing, probably maybe more than one conversation in a restorative justice mediation and thinking about that versus, you know, boom, you take them to court, the judge decides, and the rest is history, as they say. Which approach is more expensive and more time consuming, the restorative justice mediation approach or the normal judicial approach?
Well, the current way we do justice is very expensive. For instance, in Bernalillo County, where I live, it costs $323 a day to keep a youth in jail. It costs $33 a day to get them services they need. We know that the services work a whole lot better. Science has shown us that it works better than jail and that it cuts down on recidivism. And then there's the time factor also. Sometimes trials take months. They can take, you know, even longer. Most restorative justice sessions take a few hours. It's a lot quicker. Plus, you know, again, people find it much more satisfying because they get to craft the solution that works best for them rather than somebody who doesn't know them coming up with what they have decided needs to be done.
Uh-huh. And it also sounds like that would save money in attorney's fees for the victim, as well as perhaps public defender or attorney's fees for the responsible party as well.
Absolutely. We very rarely have attorneys involved. Attorneys' jobs are to speak for people. And what we do in restorative justice is the people speak for themselves.
Okay. So then is restorative justice the replacement for the justice system and the police?
Not really. It's a useful alternative in many cases. It's not an end-all be-all. We know that judges are overloaded and courts are backed up, especially since COVID. And restorative justice can be used to take some of that load off, especially in misdemeanor and juvenile cases. If we can get those cases solved, they don't have to go to court. And the same is true for the police. Restorative justice can take some of their unwanted duties off their plate, and it can be kind of a preventative. And police really aren't set up to do preventative. The job of the police starts after a crime has been committed. And with restorative justice, we spend a lot of time doing prevention. So when there's a problem, if we can get it solved to begin with, then it rarely escalates to the point where we need to bring in the police.
Okay, so then how is a restorative justice case identified? And if the police and the judicial system aren't involved, what are the ways that the responsible party is identified?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. Restorative justice is used in so many different ways. There are times when the courts or the police will refer someone to a restorative justice process if they think that whatever infraction it was not something major and they don't want to see time wasted in court or having to process somebody for a misdemeanor or process someone who's a youth. They can refer things to restorative justice. We also work with neighborhood associations and give them the opportunity that, you know, somebody complains to the neighborhood association that two neighbors at the end of the block are having a problem, then the neighborhood association can refer the complaint to restorative justice and we'll come in and do that.
I can imagine, too, that that might be perfect for those neighborhood associations that have a problem with graffiti, that if they can identify the artist, they can then perhaps have some restorative justice mediation around that as well, right?
That's one that's very, very popular, yes. Yeah, you know, and so often people do get seen. Now so many people have cameras outside their house or whatever, and, you know, they recognize. And again, as I say, the majority of those infractions are done by the same people who live in the neighborhood. So somebody's going to recognize them and turn them in. And, you know, although graffiti is certainly a problem for some people, it's not something that we necessarily want everybody who's ever done it to go to jail.
Yeah, the system would be really overloaded then, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Yeah. So then, so many questions are coming to my mind as I'm listening to you.
Right ahead.
So earlier, you mentioned how it's less expensive and more beneficial if a youth who commits a crime or an infraction is provided services rather than incarceration. What examples can you think of the kinds of services that might be in that realm?
A lot of times we get complaints or referrals from kids who've had fights in school or had fights, you know, in the neighborhood or having problems getting along with their parents. And what we do in a lot of restorative justice cases is we have a class where we actually work with the kids, talk to them about the things that are going on in their lives, and give them practical skills, things like anger management and coping skills and effective communication and de-escalation skills so that they have a different way of doing things. One of the things that we wish everybody did better was not necessarily holding kids responsible for everything. For most kids, behavior is their form of communication. You know, they don't say, gee, I'm hurting, or, you know, I can't talk to anybody or whatever. They pick up a brick and throw it through a window. And so if we sit down and talk to them, we can generally find out what's going on and then address what the problem actually is. One of the things that happens so very often when we work with kids and we do evaluations, one of the things that they say to us over and over and over again is, nobody ever talked to me. Nobody ever listened to me. Nobody ever asked me what my side of the story was. And just doing something which sounds as simple as that can make such a difference in so many children's lives.
So how do you create a safe space in restorative justice mediation for that responsible party, whether they're a youth or an adult, to actually feel safe in speaking their mind and their heart and their experience so that they can be heard, perhaps, as you're pointing out, for the first time?
Mm-hmm. We talk about the process and explain what it's going to be like and how we do it, and that the only way that it can really be successful is if everyone speaks truth and feels comfortable. And a lot of people, you know, will always say, I can't imagine a victim doing that or someone who's been hurt. But really, those are the people who most like it and most need it, because they're the ones with the questions. They're the ones who want to know, why did you do this to me? Why? You know, out of all the cars on the block, you had to smash the windows on my car. Well, there's only one person who can answer that, and that's the person who did it. And we know we're setting up a space that's safe enough that they're going to be able to answer that question.
Interesting. And I would imagine also that in that process, those responsible parties might also, as they're having to think about answering the questions that are asked them, they might actually get some self-insight as well, things that maybe they didn't even recognize, like that they were expressing an emotion with an action, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's especially the case when we're dealing with youth. It's pretty rare that they're out there doing things that they've spent a lot of time thinking about. You're right. They don't usually think about it until someone asks them why they did it. And so just being able to have to think about that in order to answer that question is one of those things that makes a difference in them doing it again.
Uh-huh. And I'm thinking back the podcast that I did a while back where I mentioned restorative justice. I talked about a restorative justice mediation that I did many years ago when I was working with New Mexico Center for Dispute Resolution. And it involved a young man, a teenage boy, who had damaged an older gentleman's property. And the outcome of the mediation was that the older gentleman had the young man come to his home and help him with repairs and things like that around the house as a way of paying back for the damage that he had done, because the boy had no money and no job and no way to make restitution. And as a result of that, the older gentleman became the young man's mentor for the rest of his life. So that's one of the beautiful stories I remember from my own restorative justice mediation experience. I'm wondering, are there any stories that you can share that are particularly poignant that you can talk about without violating confidentiality?
Yes, there are so many stories that are just like that. And the reason for them is so very often people come thinking, you know, somebody did something to me, therefore they have to be the most horrible person in the world. And they hear them speak and then they realize, you know what, this was just a confused kid or somebody who wasn't thinking about what they've done. I had an example, a case once where we had three young men from a fairly upper class, middle class neighborhood, and one of them had gotten a new truck. And the three of them thought, well, let's just see how much damage we can do with this new truck in one night. And the three of them got together, and in one night, they did damage to 42 homes in their own neighborhood.
Wow.
Yes. They had been, of course, caught, and a judge said, I think this needs to go to restorative justice because they need to know how they've affected those people. So we invited as many neighbors as wanted to attend to come, and we had a restorative justice meeting. And three young men, of course, accepted responsibility, had to apologize. But one of the things that was so moving was the people from the neighborhood said to them, you know what, we were all young once, and we all did stupid things. We don't want you to have to pay for this for the rest of your life. We don't want you to have to go to jail because you had one night of being an idiot. And the young boys were just absolutely blown away. And one of them said, I can't believe we did all of this and you're going to forgive us. And the neighbor said, well, of course we're going to forgive you because we were all young once and we know just exactly how it is. And it was amazing. It was really amazing. And I guarantee you, those three young boys will never, ever again do anything like that because they had to look their neighbors in the face. They had to look at the people that they had done something to and people saying, you know, because of you breaking windows in the middle of the night, my kids won't sleep in their rooms. And my insurance went up because I had to pay for the damages. But still, the neighbors were able to recognize that, you know, this was basically a youthful indiscretion. And they made them promise that they would never do it again. They haven't. They made them promise that they would all attend school, that they would all graduate, and that they would all go to college. And everybody in the neighborhood got an invitation to their graduation ceremony.
That's a really beautiful story, and how wonderful that they had that opportunity to essentially perhaps have their lives redirected away from what could have happened if they had been incarcerated. And we know how damaging incarceration is and how that negatively affects people's lives for the rest of their lives. And that have that opportunity to be redeemed and to also have that sort of community pressure. Hey, you need to make something of yourself and you need to do the things that will help you live life in a less destructive way. And so I know that you are recently appointed by Mayor Tim Keller to run the first restorative justice program for the city of Albuquerque. And I'm so excited for you. And I see so many possibilities in that happening. If our listeners would like to learn more about your work, how can they do that?
The easiest way is to contact me directly via email. My email address is T Covington, that's TCOVINGTON at CABQ.gov. I will answer you, and I'm always trying to encourage people to get involved with restorative justice and to try and set restorative justice up in different neighborhoods. So maybe that's a way that we can help each other.
Excellent. So anybody who is a citizen of Albuquerque can potentially harvest all that the program has to offer and also help spread the word. And then people who are not citizens of Albuquerque might be able to learn more from you so that they could get a similar program started where they are. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that everyone can benefit from restorative justice in some way. As I said, it's not an end-all be-all for everything, but it is so very useful in so many situations that it's something I really like people to think of.
I know you've been an advocate for restorative justice for many, many years, and I'm so delighted to see that it's really starting to come to fruition and be recognized in Albuquerque and hopefully throughout the country and around the world. Thank you so much, Tanya, for joining us and sharing all that you've shared with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If you have ideas for episodes of this podcast or specific things you'd like to learn about conscious communication and conflict transformation, please let me know. I want this show to have a direct and positive impact on your life. I look forward to hearing from you with your requests for advice about conscious communication or conflict transformation. I will honor whatever level of confidentiality you want in my response. I'm also happy to answer any questions you may have about anything I've shared with you. All you have to do is email me at owegon@bridgesofpeace.com. That's OWEEGON @bridgesofpeace.com. I will reply within 2 business days. You'll be able to hear a new episode of Co-Creating Peace every weekend. This episode of Co-Creating Peace has been brought to you by Bridges of Peace, providing mediation, facilitation, training, and communication coaching services throughout the U.S. and around the world. Learn more about Bridges of Peace by visiting www.bridgesofpeace.com. Thank you for listening, and may you always find new ways to co-create peace in your life.